All right, tonight's class is Parsha Vayeshev, class number 9. And the question is, were the patriarchs, the Avot, saints? Or were the Imaot, were the matriarchs saints? Does Judaism have a concept of sainthood altogether? So we're gonna explore that. That's our goal for tonight. We're gonna get in on that. And obviously the answer is gonna be somewhat nuanced. And we're gonna go to the video here. Scott Shapiro, welcome, welcome, welcome. Good to see you.
Hey, thank you.
All right, so we're going to go. This is a video on a person who is a noted Los Angeles publicist talking about the issue of damage control and crisis management, okay? And obviously I will share the relevance in a moment. Here we go.
Damage control and crisis management is a necessity. Because it's a field in PR that everybody is going to need, hopefully not. But if it does happen, there is a skill and a way to deal with it. And that's a lot of the time there's PR firms specifically specialize in crisis management. I don't, but I have had certain clients get into a jam and I've had to put my damage control hat on and do crisis management. And basically, about looking at the situation and figuring out how to clean it up, how to turn it positive. And sometimes it's simply crafting a statement to put out to the media. And sometimes it can be even lengthier, is changing a person's image. Okay, they did something bad. But now we need to flush that down and make them think of them in a different way. So a lot of the time, damage control could be charity work. They did something bad, the next thing you see them do all different acts of goodwill, and you make sure that it's photographed, and you make sure that it's covered, and make sure that, like, you're kind of changing their image to be more philanthropic than the one crisis that they had. It could be using humor. One of my favorite examples in PR is when Hugh Grant got caught with a hooker, and he went on a talk show and he was honest. Honesty is sometimes the best key in crisis management because people will forgive you if you're honest with them. And if you throw in a little bit of humor, they'll love you even more for it. So basically, Hugh Grant went on David Letterman. He was honest. He's like, yes, I did this. And then he made a joke about it that everybody laughed and thought was funny. And guess what? He was forgiven. Crisis averted. Perfect example of crisis management and damage control.
Okay. All right. All right. So we got a little taste, and of course, everybody who has been a conscious in America for the last 20 years is aware that whether you're a corporation or whether you're a celebrity or you're in a politician and you mess up or you have something which is a big problem, you will employ firms as the woman, who will deal with trying to turn it around. So what were some of the rules of crisis management that the specialist or the PR publicist brought out in the little short clip?
Do charity work.
Well, that's instrumental to what goal?
Changing people's image of you.
Right. So therefore, since we have a politician or we have a celebrity that was caught, and TMZ exposed that they did something, horrible. And now their perception in the mind of the public is that they're a horrible person. So therefore, by doing a series of charitable work, the images will people start to hopefully forget about the previous stuff and try to think of a person as a good person. What else?
Be honest.
What?
Be honest.
Right, be honest. Now, it's funny that the person did not bring that up at first, but brought up it as honesty as a tactic. But being honest. But notice how she framed, she used the Hugh Jackman situation where Hugh Jackman you know, this is going back, I think, 20 years already, where he was, you know, this viewed as a sort of like, since he's, you know, he's a British actor, very, speaks in a very urbane way. He comes across as very, you know, sophisticated person. And then, lo and behold, he gets arrested, you know, in L.A. for picking up a prostitute and engaging in some sort of, you know, whatever, sexual exchange in his car. Okay, and then he goes on to David Letterman and basically admits that he messed up, and he makes a joke about it, and the people forgave him. Okay, so that was using honesty and a joke as a way to deflect and reframe. Okay, what else? What's the first thing that corporations do, or celebrities do?
They put out a statement.
Right, they put out a statement. So we had a lot of now we've had a lot of statements recently, such as Harvey Weinstein, such as Louis C.K. as of Matt Lauer, you know, all different kinds of whether NBC, who's hired Matt Lauer. In other words, everybody wants to let me back up. What's the purpose of a statement? Why do you need a statement? The press already reported what happened. Why do you need a statement?
You can control the narrative, because if you don't do anything, then it's all the people in the news talking about you.
You said the magic words. They are controlling the narrative. In other words, people are going to frame the situation as, you know, like NBC. What are they concerned about with the Matt Lauer scandal? What's their fear?
Advertisers, Wolfley.
Why?
Because, you know, somebody who's, you know, promoting, you know, Ford cars doesn't want to be associated with somebody who sexually assaulted women.
Well, nobody's saying that NBC assaulted any women. Why do they, what's the goal of their statements concerning, you know, why they fired him?
Guilt by association?
Well, not guilt by association, or they're trying to claim that they never knew about it. This was a surprise to us, but as soon as we found out, ladies and gentlemen, we had to take decisive action. In other words, they have to sort of protect their interests by claiming that they were tzaddikim, they're righteous people, and that this was going on, and they nobody ever complained, and they never heard about this, and this was a new thing, and as soon as we knew about it, we took care of it in a decisive way. Right, they're trying to present themselves being, now in reality, nobody, but if you're a little more skeptical, what are you thinking? And you've been around the block a little bit.
You mean like they knew, but they didn't want to do anything because at the time he was bringing in millions of ad dollars?
Yeah. In other words, in general, if a person has the reputation, and we've had yet another politician, one of the oldest Congress people in the United States Congress, resigned or retired today because there were a number of complaints of sexual harassment and even or abuse. So this is happening. This is like a daily barrage we're getting here. So invariably, if you have a person who is using their position of power to coerce women to be in uncomfortable situations, it's very hard to believe, if it's happening over many, many years, that say the company didn't know about it, is a little bit suspicious, would be a gentle word, or a cover-up, or basically, as you said, Scott, that if you have a guy who's a star, a person who is making the program very successful and bringing in millions of dollars of ad revenue, then there's a motivation for people to look the other way, to hear but not hear. You know what I'm saying? And the poor little girl intern who was, you know, in her between her junior and senior year at whatever, University of Pennsylvania, whatever, who cares about what happened to her or what she said? You know what I'm saying? All right. What else? What is the role of truth in this crisis management? Sean?
Repeat the question.
What is the role of truth in crisis management?
Oh, it's the most important thing, because if you're truthful, then people will believe you and will tend to forgive also and give you another chance.
So apparently from what she said, that came out as not actually the case. That's what we hope it to be the case, Sean. But no, truth is instrumental. In other words, if they can get away with a good spin of a well-crafted corporate statement, you know, by a publicist and sort of like, you know, shape it in a certain kind of way, they'll go for that. And if they can sort of, you know, because do people like to admit that they've messed up?
No.
No, you see, even all these guys that have, you know, who've been accused of sexual harassment or abuse or even rape, are, you know, they're not admitting to it, or they're saying there is some truth, there's a little truth, but that's in it, but there's a lot of not truth. You know, it's sort of like a, you know, they have a term called the spin doctor, where they're having a publicist to craft the thing that says, I'm admitting a little bit, I'm a little wrong, but she's also a little wrong. And then it becomes a very, you know, and then the person who's not a wealthy person like the star has to think, well, do I want to get branded as a whistleblower, spend money I don't have on a lawyer to try to, you know, justify my position against this powerful person? And the answer is variably no. So you can sort of like, sometimes you can get away with it. We've not found it. Or you'll say you did it, but there's like no apology. Like one of the criticisms from Louis C.K., he admitted to it and he said it was wrong, but he never actually said, and I'm deeply sorry that I did it. There was no, you know, there was a regret of being caught, but it wasn't being sorry for doing it. You know what I'm saying? So that's the deal. All right. Now, why do I bring this up? I ask a universal question in all of the Torah and all of Tanakh. This is the million-dollar question. Does the Torah whitewash its heroes or condemn unnecessarily its villains? What do you guys say? It's a big question. What's your preliminary thought on that?
I don't think so. Because it points out for all of our heroes, it points out their flaw and the times that they make mistakes and do wrong, but it's posed in a way. So maybe you could say the answer is yes, then, because it's posed in a way for us to learn from their mistakes and to take lessons from it.
So that's called, that's no, why, what now?
The truth, not whitewashing, then.
That's not what whitewashing is to try to, is really, is like having, in other words, is the Torah like the publicist of the heroes of the Torah? Is the Torah involved in spin to try to make the hero look better than he or she really is?
No, the spin is for you to get the lesson from it.
Well, spin means you're actually giving information not truthfully or emphasizing something which is a minor thing and overemphasize something which is, you know, minimizing something major and maximizing something minor. In other words, the question could be very simple. Is the Torah giving a truthful evaluation? In other words, the narrator of the Torah, is that giving us a truthful rendition of the person?
I think it does.
Okay, based on what? What's your evidence?
Well, I think one example would be
anybody else want to wait? Who's 925?
That's me. That's Dan.
Dan last?
I was gonna say that the truth or the whole truth is not necessarily the point of the Torah. Like, it doesn't necessarily say, you know, what people are doing for Shabbat every week. Like, it doesn't have every detail of their lives. It focuses on certain events. So the point is to get the lessons out.
Well, here's the question, Dan. The question is, now, it's true that the Torah does not give a full biographical account of, quite frankly, anybody. And you're right. The Torah is not there to give us VH1 behind the music account of any one person. But the question is the Torah involved in whitewashing heroes and overly condemning villains?
It seems to it points out the flaws of our heroes nicely, that they're not perfect.
Okay, so number one. If you look through our heroes, all of them have clearly the number one hero, the number one Jew, the number one character of the Torah is, of course, is Moshe, and of course he does a sin, which of course which Hashem excoriates him, and he's punished that he can't take the Jewish people into the land of Israel. You know, in the histories of the ancient world, when historians would write about, various pharaohs or kings of the Near East, they would only talk about their tremendous victories, their successes, their riches. It would be a publicity job about how wonderful everything was under their reign. It wasn't he did this good thing, but he had a defect in this kind of way.
So my example was going to be like Yitzhak really like loving like Esau like more than like Yaakov. That seems to be a conundrum in the Torah, and then like the whole like trickery like with the birthright and like the blessing. So that's not real. That's not like whitewashing issues like that.
Right, so that's a good example that the Torah seems that the Torah shares. Now they could have more defects, we don't know, but does share the limitations or defects of the heroes. Okay, now we get to we're going to try to explore example of both of the we're going to recircle back to this question. The next question, number four, do the rabbis in their commentary whitewash its heroes and condemn unnecessarily its villains? In your exposure, whether it be in the commentators on the Chumash or in the Talmud, do you find in your experience a whitewashing, a spin, a publicist perspective?
I've never felt like you kind of, build them up as like, heroes with, infallible, like,
right.
Like perfect. I've never gotten that from any of your, speeches, any of your.
All right. But I'm trying to focus on like, for example, when we looked at a Rashi or we looked at the Talmud, has your experience been a whitewashing?
I think to some extent that's true.
Yes. The surface reading of, statements of the Talmud and of some of the commentators is a seemingly functioning as a defense lawyer or a good publicist for the various misdeeds that they do. So we're gonna actually, instead of pouring that, I just want to get your sense of things, but we're going to look at an example and I'm going to try to share how to approach this in general. Sort of give you a universal methodology here, okay?
Like in my example, like the commentaries try to say that Yaakov like didn't really like lie to, or maybe it's okay to lie in certain circumstances. It's like how they whitewash some things.
Right. So correct. On the surface, it seems that they're trying to whitewash him being that he was, you know, clearly from the text, Yaakov, under the guidance of his mother, Rivka, purposely and fraudulently deceived his father. That's a fact. Okay? So one of the famous lines, it seems like a whitewash, I'll just give it a simple example, is Rashi says, when Yaakov says, Ani Esav Bechorecha, I am Esav, your firstborn, there's sort of a pause. Ani, I am, comma, Esav is your firstborn. Now, this seems to be a complete distortion of what exactly he said. It's very Clintonian to go back for our good friend William Jefferson Clinton, our president, when he says, I did not have sex with that woman. Right? What he meant was, I did not have, you know, when he got cross-examined in his impeachment trial, I did not have intercourse with that woman, but I don't view oral sex as sex. So, yeah, I didn't have sex with that woman. A true statement. You know what I mean? Deceptive, but a true statement. Right? So, it sounds like a Bill Clinton special that Rosh is trying to put in Rosh's mind. I'll give you an idea that I heard from my own teacher, Rabbi Chait. He said, the reality is Yaakov deceived him. What is Rashi trying to point out to? Is that there are situations where halachically, morally, you must lie. For example, you lie to prevent people getting hurt. Not for self-preservation, you're lying. You don't want people to be upset, okay? If a woman says, do I look fat in the dress? The answer is no. Okay? That's the only answer. There is no other answer. If you want to say the other answer, you're an idiot. No, we lie and may show them bias, okay? But part of the thing, what Rabbi Chait pointed out, there's a satisfaction we get, even if we're allowed to lie. There is an enjoyment and a satisfaction in lying. So what Rashi is trying to point out to is that in doing it in a hesitant kind of way, he's trying to stop himself from sort of being, you know, enjoying or getting satisfaction in the lie. His hesitation is he's trying to restrain himself from getting a full satisfaction from the con, because there's a part of all of us that enjoy manipulating and controlling and lying to people. That is an enjoyment. That's why people who are pathological, they rather tell a lie than the truth. Okay, there's a reality to that. So that's his understanding of the Rashi. Okay, let's go on to the actual parsha, and let's have somebody read. This is the class, one of the best stories in the Tanakh. This is a mega one. Okay, who would like to read? We have Shana, go ahead.
Meanwhile, Yaakov settled in the area where his father had lived in the land of Canaan. These are the chronicles of Yaakov. Yosef was 17 years old. As a lad, he would tend the sheep with his brothers, the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. Yosef brought his father a bad report about them. Yisrael loved Yosef more than any of his other sons, since he was the child of his old age. He made Yosef a long, colorful coat. When his brothers realized that their father loved him more than all the rest, they began to hate him. They could not say a peaceful word to him. Then Yosef had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him all the more. "Listen to the dream I had," he said to them. "We were binding sheaves in the field when my sheaf suddenly stood up erect. Your sheaves formed a circle around my sheaf and bound down to it. Do you want to be our king?" retorted the brothers. "Do you intend to rule over us?" Because of his dreams and words, they hated him even more. He had another dream and told it to his brothers. Oh, I just had another dream, he said. The sun, the moon, and 11 stars were bowing down to me. When he told it to his father and brothers, his father scolded him and said, "What kind of dream did you have? Do you want me, your mother, and your brothers to come and prostrate ourselves on the ground to you?" His brothers became very jealous of him, but his father suspended judgment.
Okay. All right. This is such a good story. We can make a Broadway musical about it. Too late. They did. Okay. All right. Part number one, the crisis. How would you characterize Yosef's level of awareness of his brother's jealousy?
He was aware. They basically told him.
They told him?
He didn't know until he told him I don't think he knew, because if he had known, he wouldn't have told him about the second dream.
Well, in 37:8, it says, "Do you want to be our king?" retorted the brothers. "Do you intend to rule over us?" So clearly, like, there's like animosity, and they like.
Oh right, yeah, that was.
Yeah, but I didn't ask if the brothers expressed. Look, they said they could not speak peaceably to him.
No,
so I didn't ask that question. It says, How would you characterize Yosef's level of awareness of his brother?
The one, yeah.
He's oblivious to it.
Yeah.
Oblivious. Zero. Zero self-awareness.
Because he kept doubling down and tripling down.
Yeah, it's like, have you ever been to, let's say, a social situation, let's say like a kiddish, where you see you're in a conversation, and one person talking to the other person, and you clearly see their face tighten up. You see they're getting like infuriated by what the person is saying. They're finding it insulting, demeaning, irritating. But the other person is not picking up the clue, and they continue to go on and on and on. Have you ever seen that?
Sure, yeah.
So that's a person who suffers from a clinical condition, a fancy clinical condition called unawareness. The state of picking up zero social cues. Okay? And Yosef is, first of all, he's bringing bad reports about them. Okay? We all know the rule in life. Snitches, finish it off.
Get stitches.
Snitches get stitches. So he is snitching to his dad about the Torah does not say, because it doesn't make a difference. And of course, they what? Okay, so that's step one. Two, Yaakov or Yisrael loves him more. And what does he do to show his love?
He makes him a long, colorful coat.
Right. Well, the Hebrew is a ketonet pasim, the multicolored coat, long, colorful coat. Okay. Then when the brothers saw that he loved them more, they hated him, and they couldn't say one nice word to him. Okay. So the situation already at this point, if he had a little bit of self-awareness, he would sort of keep his little special little dreams to himself. But what was his feeling? He's acting as if what? Suzanne? From his perception, what's his perception of the situation?
That they care. I mean, that he's so important and they care.
Of course they would love this. How could they not? I had a dream. Wouldn't they love to know this? You can't even imagine that they wouldn't.
Does he have this inflated sense of self because of the way his father treated him?
An excellent question. That gets me to question number two.
Oh.
All right, so Suzanne, read me out question number two.
Rashi tells us of the Midrash that Yosef as a Na'ar, he behaved.
The terrorist calls him Hunar, and he was literally a teenager. Now, obviously, since the terror gives us his age of 17 years old, well, we know he's a Nar because that's his age. So it learns an additional lesson, which is what?
Well, he's immature.
Okay, so what does it say? What does the letter say?
He behaved childishly, fixing his hair and touching up his eyes so that he would appear handsome.
So interesting, the Midrash learned that part of Yosef, in addition to bad reports and telling the dreams, what was the idea? He was very much into his looks. You know what I mean? What's that all about? If you have a guy, he's always looking in the mirror and fixing up his looks.
He's a narcissist. A little bit.
Okay, so Suzanne mentioned that he's a narcissist, a person engaged in tremendous self-love. Okay? How does that fit into youth? Why is that a feature of a person who is a young person? David Goldson, are you with us?
I am, yes.
So in your experience, when a person's 17 years old and looking at the mirror and constantly doing their hair,
maybe he's insecure or, maybe he's insecure.
So you're saying that the reason why he's trying to ensure that he looks great is because it's coming from a rather low self-esteem.
Possibly.
Okay.
Or he's self-absorbed.
Self-absorbed. So that goes back to what Suzanne was saying, that there was an issue of he's narcissism, self-love. How does that, what does it mean by, explain that a little more. What does it mean that the person's in self-love? What does that really, how does that work? Why?
Goes with being immature and, wanting attention.
In other words, if you're saying that he's self-absorbed, he views himself as being uniquely special, and therefore he's a person who should, of course, always look phenomenal, and he's very much concerned about how he's perceived in the family or the public, and he's giving himself. Ranking himself as being intrinsically very, very, very important. And therefore, right. He has to look phenomenal. It's an overestimation of the self. That's what you think. And it could, of course, go on because either A, he feels very low, and therefore he has to compensate, or B, no, he has his inflated sense of self, and this is just a natural expression. Right? Are those the two possibilities that you're conveying?
Yes.
Okay.
For lack of humbleness.
Okay, that's another aspect of when a person feels empty or lacking, they try to find other compensating things to sort of fill the hole. Okay, those are three possibilities. Okay, so I want you guys to all put on your parenting hat and answer question number three. How would you have handled the tensions between the children? Let's say you're Yaakov. What would you guy have done?
Was it one of the rules of parenting not to have like favorites? So not to like
love
one child over another?
Yeah, you just say, I love you, all of you equal.
Right. So the bottom line is, one does not have to be a great child psychologist to realize. Now, do parents have favorites?
Absolutely.
Does everybody agree with that? Scott, do you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, some kids get
obviously everybody on the call is your parents' favorite. Okay, that goes without saying.
Yeah, I know I am.
that's of course without a doubt. But my question to you is everybody agrees that parents do have favorites. Now I will say to you, of course they have favorites because it's and I'll prove it, and I'll prove it very simply. Everybody here has friends, and but I guarantee you that your best friend in fourth grade is not the same best friend you had in 10th grade, and certainly not your best friend that you have right now. So the position of who's your best friend is constantly in flux. So that's an emotional relationship. So certainly it's natural to have pick a favorite of your parents to pick a favorite. Now the key point is what Sean said, it's not a problem of, the issue is not having a favorite. What is a key point?
Not telling them.
Yes.
Your favorite.
And how did Yaakov do as a job as a parent in this regard?
Not well.
Not well. What was the big seeming error he made here?
He even gave like a coat to his favorite.
Right. He made a big, a very special coat.
It was like a shiny coat, like a.
Right. It was. I don't know what shiny, but it was multicolored. The key thing here was not just a coat. In other words, if he picked him up a regular standard coat, right, because he needed a coat for the winter, let's say, I don't think that, no, but specifically he's making a coat. It's akin to like a correlate. It's like a coronation coat, in reality. That's how they felt it. Now, so we're going to give Yaakov, from the, what they call the Pshuta Shel Mikra, from the plain reading of the text, it seems, so what role did this immaturity, whether it be I'm going to put in two things, either I'm going to expand the question. What did Yosef's immaturity play into the brother's hatred and jealousy? And part two is, what did the role of Yaakov's seeming lack of awareness or parenting skill play into the brother's hatred and jealousy?
It fed fueled the brother's hatred and jealousy.
How so?
Well, the father, Yaakov giving Yosef the jacket, clearly says, this is my favorite. And the other brothers then say, well, what about us? And that just gives them, it's their ammunition that they're not their father's favorite.
Well, how do children feel about discovering that they're not their parents' favorite? How does that go?
Well, from personal experience, I accused my parents of my brother being the favorite, and my brother would say, well, no, Shane is the favorite, and my parents would then answer, we love you both the same.
Good. They did a good job. Somebody's lying, but whatever, they did a good job. I don't know, I don't know. I can't comment on that, but anyways, so we have here is a perfect storm of disaster. On one hand, you got self-absorbed Yosef, who is so absorbed he is blinded by a tremendous state of unawareness, and he imagines that that his brothers would be totally cool with A, him bringing bad reports of some misdeeds that they have done, A, B, him walking around with his gorgeous coat that his dad gave him because he loves him more, three, sharing the first dream of the sheaves, and they're all bowing down to him, and they say, oh, you want to be king? And four, throwing additional salt on the wound by sharing the next dream of the sun and the moon and the 11 stars all bowing down to him. Okay. Now, did Yaakov try to tamp down the situation at all?
A little, but didn't he scold Yosef?
He did. He did. What kind of dream did you have? You want me and your mother and brothers to come and prostrate yourself on the ground to you? How effective was that scolding insofar as to neutralize the feelings of jealousy and hatred?
Wasn't too effective.
Right. It says that his brother became very jealous of him.
So worsened it.
His father suspended judgment. Why did he suspend judgment? That's a very key point.
Because Zophus was his favorite, so he kind of, in some ways, agreed with Joseph, or thought it was okay.
Or maybe this dream might be have a prophetic character to it.
Right.
Now, let's get into part two. So you guys have laid down the blame for both Yosef and Yaakov, his dad, are complicit in the disaster.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you also have to give some blame to the brothers, okay? They are all, maybe if they acted more maturely also, they would have been less angry about it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, let's take a look at the Rashi. The Midrash blames Yaakov. According to the rabbis, it was Yaakov's desire to live in Olam Haba, a completely undisturbed world of terror that created Yosef's crisis. This is Rashi. I gave the translation. All right, so let's have somebody read. All right, Suzanne, read it out. Rashi over here.
It is further expounded upon as follows. Dwelt, verse 1, when Yaakov sought to dwell in tranquility, the troubles of Yosef sprang upon him. The righteous seek to dwell in tranquility. Said the Holy One, blessed be he, isn't the great reward that is prepared for the righteous in the world to come sufficient for them that they also seek to dwell in tranquility in this world?
Okay. So it's interesting. Yaakov wants to live in tranquility. And then the troubles of Yosef sprang upon him. So the Rashi seems to be saying, why are these problems happening? Not because Yaakov's doing a terrible job of parenting. What's his problem? Says the Rashi. He wants to be in tranquility. Okay, so that seems to be what? An Olam Haba. And he wants to live in a world to come like basis. He wants to withdraw from this world and involved in terror study. All right. So stopping right here. Is that a whitewash? Whitewash or no whitewash? Spin or no spin?
Spin.
What do you say, Shayna? Spin or no spin?
Spin.
Suzanne, spin or no spin?
I'll go with the spin.
For 500 points on the square. Does everybody? All right. So on the surface, this seems to be like a great PR job. It's not that he's doing a terrible job parenting. No! He wants to live in a tranquil world of Olam Haba. And apparently Hashem's got a limited amount of tranquility to go around. And he's saying that you, Yosef, you're going to get a whole bunch later on. You can't start cashing in now. And I'm going to send to you the troubles of Yosef. As you know, later on in the Parsha, the brothers actually have so much jealousy and aggression toward him that they do what to him? What do the brothers do later in the Parsha?
They sell him.
They sell him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, which he only gets sold to, ultimately ending up as a slave sold into
Egypt.
Okay. All right. So here we go. Question number 5. What impact would yearning for Olam Haba have on a leader's tolerance for the pain of leading the community? It's a little bit of a nuanced question. I'll repeat it again. What impact would yearning for Olam Haba have on a leader's tolerance for the pain of leading the community?
I would say it would reduce the tolerance.
What do you mean by that? It's quite a little more.
So if you want to live in a tranquil place, then you're going to have a interest in downplaying or ignoring anything that's disturbing the tranquility.
Correct. And as the leader of the family, what's the problem?
You kind of have to confront the pain and resolve the issue as opposed to just pretending like it's not there.
Correct. Being a leader is extremely painful. You have to, all the problems come to you. Okay? So it's that there's an intrinsic problem. Conflict between tranquility and being a leader are literally the opposites. You cannot be a leader and live in tranquility. Impossible. So obviously, if you're a leader and you're having a hard time with the pain of the challenge, you definitely want to withdraw into another world. Okay, question number 6. This is Rashi, a case of rabbinic whitewashing, excusing Yaakov as a great man who simply wanted to learn Torah. All of you guys said, yes, it is indeed a case of rabbinic whitewashing, excusing Yaakov as a great man who simply wanted to learn Torah. Okay. And clearly, this is an important life lesson off the bat, before we get into the meat of the matter. What do we learn about this, about the ideal way to balance responsibilities with Torah study? What is that? On the surface of the Midrash, what is he saying about the best way to balance responsibilities with Torah study?
You can't shun your responsibilities just to study Torah. You have to find a balance to do both.
Correct. So in Israel, let's play this out on a national level. In Israel, one of the major lightning rod issues is we have the Haredim, translated as the ultra-Orthodox, who are refusing to do any kind of military or national service. Rather, they want to withdraw and learn full-time. So this Rashi would not really support that, or would not support that either as an internal balance. What program in the Army is a harmonization of this problem? Anyone have a name? Okay, so we saw many soldiers who are part of a 5-year HESDER program where they do learning and Army, and it's divided up in an 8 and a 5-year plan versus the 3 years that the Israeli regular Israeli soldiers perform. Next challenge, of course, if you enjoy learning, you want to do learning all the time. You want to do what you enjoy. But there's a thing called making a living. So you can't stay home and learn or stay learn eternally and hope to be supported by somebody else. Clearly, this chazal is not supporting that position. All right, but that's another thing. Now, I want to get into the nature of Yaakov's error. Okay? And I want to go back to understand really the nature of this Rashi. Because really, on the surface, I agree with you. This looks like spin, rabbinic whitewashing. But I want to show you how Midrashim really operate. They tell us the story behind the story. Okay. So Rashi quotes Unkelus. Unkelus is, anybody who knows, tell me who Unkelus is. Anybody know who Unkelus is? Who's Unkelus? Not Uncle Lewis. Unkelus.
Wasn't he a commentator also?
Kinda. Kinda. Unkelus, described by in the Talmud as being a Roman convert to Judaism, wrote an Aramaic translation of the 5 books of Moshe, and that become the official translation of the Torah. And now look what he does when it says that Yaakov, he loved him more because he was a son of his old age. He translated the word Zakein. Why? Read it out there, Shana.
For he was a wise son to him. Whatever he had learned from Shem and Eber, he gave over to him.
Okay, so Unkelus It's saying not that he's a son of his old age, because in a certain sense, he has all of his kids were born to him when he was pretty old. The difference between the ages of the tribes is not that different. So he's going to Ben Zikunim. Ben Zikunim is a he's translating as Bar Hakim. Zakein has a double Zakein. Elderly has a double entendre in the Torah. Can mean an old person or can mean a wise person. In other words, because typically, God willing, when all of you guys grow old, you also grow wiser. That's the goal. Unfortunately, there is something called an old fool. That's not a Zakein. He could be old, but he's not a Zakein in the true sense. And what's as they say, the rabbis say, what is an old, what is a Zakein? Mi shekana chachma, he who has acquired wisdom. What Uchlis gives from this perspective gives us an understanding of, well, why did Yaakov favor Yosef? Well, quite frankly, he gravitated to Yosef because he was an extremely wise son. And it's and Rashi adds the comment, and everything he learned in, there's a yeshiva that Yaakov went to, midrashically, Shem and Aver. So all of his knowledge that Yaakov has, who's a prophet, who's filled with knowledge, he gave over to Yosef. Why is he giving over the wisdom to specifically Yosef? Obviously, learning with the rest of his kids, but why more Yosef? Why? What's he trying to do here?
Yosef could understand, so he was trying to pass on the mantle to the next generation.
Exactly. Since he was the most gifted student, he wanted to pass on all the wisdom of Judaism that he had gained so far. What did he also want to do? Implied in this, and this is the source of the problem. Take it one step further, Dan.
He also wants to ensure that the Torah values will pass on to future generations.
Well, of course, but what does he really want to do, which might be premature?
He wants to kind of bless him or, you know, officially recognize him as the heir.
Exactly. Let me translate this into a contemporary situation, which will make the matter crystal clear. Most businesses in America are family-owned and operated business. One of the most trickiest things that businesses experience is passing on leadership from the founder generation, called the dad, to the next generation, okay? So you have a situation where you have a number of the sons working in a family business. Is it simple to pass on that business to the child?
No.
What are some of the problems?
One, they could be bad at it and, you know, run the company into the ground.
Okay.
Or two, right. They could be good at it, but they, you know, maybe they want to become, you know, do something else with their career. You know, there's always that possibility.
Right. So you have the problem of the child that doesn't want to take over the business, or the child who's really not up to the job. Now, you could be not up to the job for two possible reasons. What are they?
Sometimes, you know, being an entrepreneur and like a leader takes, you know, it takes a certain something, and maybe, you know, it's not a bad thing, but not everybody has it.
Okay, so number one is that the child does not have the skill set or latent talent necessary to be good at that job. Doesn't mean he's not a good person.
Right.
It just means he's not a good fit. But the parent does not want to see that or accept that and wants their child, the specific child, to take over. And that could be a disaster, number one. But let's say the child does have the talent and the thing. What's another problem that could be a problem?
if there's more than one child.
Right. So there's going to be, when you have to, when you're passing on the mantle of leadership, that has to be done rather slowly. Because, first of all, just because you think a child has the latent talent to be the leader, it takes a bunch of years of experience and learning to really do the job. What I'm arguing in Tirashi, that Yaakov sought to dwell into tranquility, really the problem here is, yes, did he like Yosef more? Yes. But Unklus and Rashi are giving us sort of a causal factor. And was that a mistake? It was a mistake. But what was animating that mistake? What's animating that mistake is that he looked at Yosef, he saw tremendously precocious, bright, capable, and talented person. Now, by the way, was his read of Yosef on the mark? What's your proof? There's a powerful proof. Was Yaakov's read assessment of Yosef on the mark?
It was.
What's your proof?
Well, both of the dreams essentially were true, and he became a great leader.
He actually de facto was Paro's right-hand man and averted a national catastrophe of epic proportions and continued to run the government for nearly 80 years. So this is a person who's got what they call mad skills. All right, this guy is usually talented. What was Yaakov's mistake? This happens all the time. Either two extremes happen, but this is a category. The founder is tired. He sees one child is clearly qualitatively better and skilled than the rest. What does he do? He slides the keys across the conference table and says, "Buddy, enjoy. There's a condo in Florida with my name on it. Don't call too often. I'm out." Okay? Is that a good transition plan?
No.
Just because you feel tired, just because you've had an exhausting life, does not make your child ready for a transition. The transition is a very delicate thing. And he wanted to sort of, you could argue his giving of the coat of many colors is trying to motivate him to be further involved and further engaged. But that was a disaster. He did not take into the psyche of his brothers. Now his brothers, you know, are also, he thought his brothers were like 20 years old. They're not going to be a bunch of babies. Chazal say, not true. Unbelievable Rambam. This is halacha. Our sages commanded that a person should not differentiate between his children in his lifetime, even with regard to a small matter, lest it spawn competition and envy, as happened with Yosef and his brothers. There is no end to the age when a person can handle parental favoritism. With all the kids are 50 years old, and there's a Hanukkah party, and you give all kids something minor, and you give one kid like something worth 20 times the value of what everybody did, that is a disaster, regardless of the age. So Yaakov made an error there. But what is Rashi trying to tell? It says, look, and this gets to our initial question. What is wrong in viewing the Avot, the patriarch, as being just like us? And conversely, what is wrong with looking at them as angels?
Because then we miss the lessons that are kind of presented
Is Yaakov just like us or a little bit worse?
Yes, in a lot of ways. A lot of parents do that.
No, it seems that Rashi's saying that his motivation was seemingly to pass on the mantle prematurely. He wanted to involve himself in Torah study. In other words, is he just like us? He's making a mistake. That is unquestionable. But is he just like us?
No. Not in that. No.
Is he making the same kind of mistake that we're making?
No, because as you just said, he just wanted to sit and learn Torah all day. Whereas somebody like the dad who's ready to retire to Florida isn't going to necessarily sit and learn Torah all day, but is going to enjoy the life of Florida.
Right. He'll do a little golf. He might, you know, put on some white shoes. He might, you know, do the 4 o'clock dinner with his friends. You know, all the stuff about living in Florida. All the fun time. So the bottom line is that he's not motivated so we can have a life of leisure in that sense. He felt that he had did his time. He wants to retire from leading the family and pass on the mantle of leadership to his son, who's the most capable. The problem is that just because he was had that desire. And just because Yossi is very, very smart and very, very capable, it doesn't take into account the dynamics of the family, which was a disaster. And it caused, basically, Yosef to get enslaved and the Jewish people to end up in Egypt. So it was a double disaster. So now let's go the other way. What's wrong with them looking as angels? Why would you think they're like angels? What separates Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov from us?
They're prophets.
No, number one, they're prophets. What else? God's doing miracles for them. God's making covenants for them. God's communicating with them. Has God made a covenant with anybody, with any of you guys lately, individually? I don't think so. So clearly, he's not a regular guy in the sense that, because not everybody has an authentic, a providential and relationship which involved in miracles and prophetic relationship as Yaakov had. That's on one hand. But on the other hand, doesn't mean that they are perfect. They're perfect. They make mistakes. But their mistakes, really, what the Chazal are trying to say is very simply, yes, they made mistakes. What the Rosh trying to say is, don't make the error that his mistake is based on making a first grade blunder of parenting showing favoritism. His interest was, he had a phenomenal son who was deeply talented, who ultimately was the leader of the family. But since he was motivated to sort of like get out of the role of dealing with a he's close to 100 years old, and or maybe even older, 107, I don't know the exact math, and he's like had enough. He's had nothing but sorrows. So, in a certain sense, you can sort of like forgive him while you want to sort of super accelerate passing the baton. Typically, with parents passing the baton in family businesses, you either have two extremes. Either A, the parent quickly and unthoughtfully pass on the baton to a child in the business, which ends disastrously, as Scott points out, sometimes the child, since he's not either not a good fit, or B, did not get sufficient training, runs the business into the ground, or the parent, which is probably more common, the parent that never leaves, the parent that can't let go, the parent that needs to come into the office when they're 92 years old and can't let their son, who's 55, actually do what they're eminently qualified as they have been involved in business for the last 30 years. So you have two extremes, the parent that can't let go or the parent that has a poor plan of passing of the baton and ends, improperly. So here's the basic punchline. Whenever you're going to see statements in the Midrash or in the Talmud or brought down by the Mefarshim, like Rashi and others, that on the first blush seems like whitewashing, as a strategy of dealing with that is to say like this. If the Avot are angels, well, that makes them also nobody we can learn from because we're not angels. So that's not helpful to us. Because then they're basically saying they're not people. If you make them people just like us, that's distorting because although we're people, we're not prophets. God's not doing miracles for us individually, and he's not making eternal covenants with us. So typically, we're assuming that's based upon some measure of merit and deservedness. So they're probably not the exact same as us. So what the Rashi and the Midrashim and the Chazal, the rabbis are pointing out, is that really there is the nature of their error is a little bit more subtle than comes to mind. Because otherwise, you'll have on the surface, Yaakov is a world-class bumbling idiot making a parental mistake that God willing none of us would even make at all. So that makes him less than anybody. That seems a little bit hard to understand if he's also Yaakov, who's the founder of the Jewish people. On the other hand, the Torah says that he's showing the favoritism. And we learn halacha of what not to do. Not only is it not good parenting, it's halachically forbidden to show a difference among your kids. We're coming up on Hanukkah. If you cannot give 8 presents to one kid and 2 gifts to the other. Got to be even, Steven. Now, kids, by the way, have an internal algorithm. Their mind is clued into Amazon. They know the relative price tag of every single gift you're going to get them. And if they sense that you paid $47 for one and $22 for another, they will sense that differentiate. Okay? You cannot do that. Okay? So that's lesson number one. So the key point is, the first question we started with, were the patriarchs saints? No. There are no saints. Man, by definition, is fallible and makes mistakes. But within people, there are great people. They make less mistakes. And not only that, their mistakes are perhaps of a more subtle nature. And that's really what the Chazal are pointing out. You do not brush Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, and Rachel, and Leah in the same brush as you would as your local baker or the guy Sal who's your dry cleaner. That would be really not capturing their essence. Because if that was the case, that would also negate the purpose of the Torah. In other words, you gotta be in that sweet spot. If they're angels, we can't learn from them. If they're regular people, what's the point? We don't need them, we could just see regular people. So they're a cut above us, and their mistakes they make are a little bit of a more subtle nature, but they do make mistakes. And of course, with that are universal lessons, which we started with, which we all can gain from. And clearly, Yosef is in his youth, look through the Parsha, two Parshiot, Yosef himself go through a process of maturation. And it's achieved through the school of hard knocks, through the challenges that he faces through his life. All right, that is an example of the issue that we visited, and as we go forward. So, any questions?
I have a quick question.
Yes.
You mentioned the term, like, saints. Like, when I think of saint, I think of, like Christians have, like, saints. So, yeah. In Judaism, we have the concept of saints, and if so, isn't it more like we call people like tzaddiks? Is that like our version of like a saint, like calling somebody a tzaddik?
No. A saint implies a person who seems like a perfect, sinless person. It says in Kohelet that there's no man on land that doesn't sin. So man is intrinsically a sinner. Not doomed, but we're going to make mistakes. Some people make a lot more than others. A tzaddik is a person whose essential character is righteous in all their ways. You know, or the vast majority of them. Doesn't mean they don't make any mistakes. They make some mistakes, but the character of tzaddik means that their character, by and large, is a righteous one. And they meet life's challenge in a very thoughtful, reflective way. And their life, and by watching them, you can learn from how they navigate life and improve yourself. Mm-hmm. Not a saint, a tzaddik, is a righteous person.
All right. So by definition, someone can't be a saint.
No saints.
Mm-hmm. Impossible. Right. The only other comment was I was thinking about this, like with Yaakov. It seems like he has like a pattern of showing like favoritism, like it says that he loved Rachel more than like Leah.
Right.
So he had his favorites in multiple cases.
Well, that's not quite the exact same thing, because he really only wanted to be married to Rachel, and he got this extra wife, Leah. So that's sort of understandable that, you know, the wife that you wanted versus the wife that you didn't really want. So it's not, you know, that's not the exact same way, you know what I mean? But even that, it's once you're left with that, should you have been more, that's a good question. If he should have been how he handled that should have been more, you know, better in handling that situation. Mm-hmm. So that's a basic deal. There's more to talk about here, but it gives you a little sense of how to navigate the general question about the Torah, the rabbis, our heroes, saints or scoundrels, regular people or angels, that kind of issue. All right, guys, have a great night. I'll see some of you tomorrow. You
will.
Good night.
Good night.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Night.
If I may. So as I was reading, at the beginning, it talks about Yaakov, and then it switched to calling him Yisrael.
Yes. So
in the authorship of the Torah, we know that he goes by both names. But how is there a reason why they'll refer to him as Yaakov or as Yisrael when they do?
Okay, that's a great question. That's actually worthy of a class. Okay, so I can't answer it on the dime.
Okay.
Excellent question, Shana. Good. Another Shana special. Thank you so much.
Thank the rabbi.
Bye.
Have a good night.